Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Travel Royally podcast. Thanks for tuning in. We are sponsored by our company, Royal Links Golf Tours. We specialize in customizing golf trips to the British Isles, Scotland, Ireland, England, and Wales. If you're ready to start planning your vacation, please reach out to us at our website, royallinksgolftours.com. Today on the podcast, we have Mr. Alan Patterson. He is the director of golf courses and estates at Turnberry in Scotland. Hope you enjoy.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Travel Royally podcast. We're thrilled to have you today, and we're very excited to have as our guest, Alan Patterson. He's the director of golf courses and estates at Turnberry in Scotland. And Alan started his greenkeeping experience or career in 1985. He was a junior member at Powerfoot. And he helped by divoting fairways during the summer holidays. A member of the team left. The head greenkeeper asked him if he wanted to be an apprentice greenkeeper. He started as an apprentice greenkeeper, and as they say, the rest is history. From there, he moved on to Glen Eagles Hotel, where he was responsible for the King's Course, the Queen's Course, and the Wee Course. He left in 2005 to be the course manager for the construction crew and the grow-in crew at the seventh course at St. Andrews, which is now known as the Castle Course. From there, he moved to where he is now, which is at Trump Turnberry, and that was in 2015. And it was a busy start to his career there because they were doing a resort renovation. They had a new pitch and putt. A short-range practice facility was built. And then immediately following that, they had the RICO British Women's Open that July, and then the full renovation of the ELSA course and the hotel started in that September. You were hella busy back then, but welcome to the Travel Royally podcast, Alan.
Jeff, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Do you like the backdrop I have? I did that just for you.
I do like that. Just as we were saying before, off we came on here, that it'd be nice to see some of that blue sky come back. It's not been the best of winters, but hopefully that's just round the corner.
Well, I've been there multiple times, been able to play and stay. I've stayed in both the hotel and in the lodges out, kind of down on the lower level. Absolutely fantastic. And I'm not saying this just because you're here, but I truly believe that you have one of the finest courses in the world, let alone Scotland. And you've got a course with just absolutely spectacular views. And the picture behind me literally doesn't do it justice.
Yeah, well, I'm very fortunate that, you know, it's a very, very special place. You know, I always... There's views, you know, some days that they're stunning. And I sometimes wonder what it'd be like for the person that, you know, looks at them for the first time. You know, it doesn't wear on me seeing them every day, certainly. So I certainly were fortunate to work in such a beautiful part of the world and, you know, say one of the world's finest golf courses, golf resorts. So, yeah, it's a treat.
Yeah. Well, I've got I want to start at the beginning. How did you come to golf in the first place?
It was my friends started playing golf, and then they started playing a little bit, and then one of my friends decided that it was time to buy himself a new set of golf clubs. This is probably 1981, 82. So he said, look, I've got a set of golf clubs for sale, and you can have them for £35. So, I mean, my parents were working class, so £35, you know, they were hardworking people, and, you know, at that time money was... scarce, shall we say. So £35, it doesn't sound an awful lot of money. But I had a few wee bit of savings and I bought a set of golf clubs. At that point, I think junior membership at Powfoot was, I'm going to say, £45 to £50 a year. Back in the day, that was the good old days where you had, you know, 82, there was a waiting list for junior members, which...
Wow.
Well, I know if you, in the current climate, we were talking about that today, that you know, those days are kind of long gone. So started playing golf, got absolutely hooked on it. Powfoot, great little links course in the southwest of Scotland. That's one is if people have never played it, great wee part of the world. You've got that. You've got Silverness just around the corner as well. So a great little private members club. Out of bounds right on the first four holes, so not conducive to a slicer. But great, loved it. Just got hooked on golf. Again, was never good enough to be, you know, professional or think about being professional. And then I used to help out, as I said, Divot Fairways with the school kids used to go in the school holidays.
Yeah.
I remember a staff left and I head greenkeeper, Ian Taylor, rest his soul, came along and said, "Do you want to be an apprentice greenkeeper?" And I went, "That'll do me." And then that was a 15-second job interview.
Yeah.
And then you see the rest is history. And then you summarised in 30 seconds a 40-year career.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but I think it's an amazing career because, as you said, you came from working-class parents playing at a little-known course called – and I don't mean little-known because it's not a great course in Powell. I played Southerness and Silithon Solway, which aren't too far away from there, and absolutely love that area of the UK. But you've had a remarkable career. You went to Glen Eagles, which is, you know, a Ryder Cup venue and Jack Nicklaus design course. And, you know, it's a wonderful facility. And then you went to St. Andrews, which is, you know, one of the best places to work in the world for your profession. And then Turnberry, it's you've been at three of the certainly top 100, I would say top 50 golf courses in the whole world.
Yeah, so we're fortunate. Well, I was at Powfoot and I was deputy there, and my boss at that time, he was probably head greenkeeper, you know, maybe half a dozen years away from retirement. And then out of the blue, Glen Eagles advertised for entry level. Level one greenkeepers, which was rare. So I thought, look, I'm going to throw my name in the hat. And then I went in there in 94 as level one and then just worked my way up. So I went to deputy and then I was head greenkeeper of the Kings, Queens and the Wee Course in about 98 and below, like a Scott Fenwick, who's still director of Golf Course Estates now. So Scott said he was my old boss. And then Jimmy Kidd, who was kind of states, bit of a different old, but states director at that point. So that was a great opportunity. Went in just before the last Scottish Open in 94. Started on the Queen's course, then they amalgamated the 36 holes, and then just worked my way up there. And then again, 2005 came along where St Andrews were looking to take a course manager on from day one of construction, and which they wanted to do it in a slightly different way, where without a principal contractor, they wanted to build a seventh course, but didn't want to sort of, you know, blow the budget completely or the bank completely. So they were going to break it up into separate parts and separate components. So they needed a, you know, course manager to go in from to assist with kind of the management of and be there for the basically construction, the final prep, and the growing and take it to opening, which is a fantastic opportunity. You don't really get that kind of style of construction very often. So fantastic, and obviously great period of time there. And obviously then got a phone call to say if we'd be interested in coming down to have a chat about Turnberry. My predecessor, Ewan Grant, had left, and I'd be interested in coming having a chat, which you're pinching yourself at that point, certainly so. And then that was, believe it or not, that's about a very, very quick 9 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you mentioned Jimmy Kidd, that he, for people who are listening and are familiar, that's David McClay Kidd's father,
that's
who
correct,
for years was at Glen Eagles. And David McClay Kidd has gone on to have a tremendous career here in the States, but doing work all over the world, really, right?
Yeah, it certainly has. I haven't spoken to Jimmy for a good few years, but I believe he's still doing a bit of consultancy for, or was for David on some of his constructions and growing. So yeah, long illustrious career. You know, he certainly has had that.
Yeah. Well, you know, we had another connection we talked about earlier, John Murray, who's a golf pro at Murray Golf Club, where I'm a member, was there at Glen Eagles as an assistant pro back, you know, 25 years ago or so when you were still there. And then, so then you move on to St. Andrews after Glen Eagles, and St. Andrews created that amazing golf course there, the seventh. And at what point did you get there? Was the construction over and it was just the grow in, or were you there for kind of for the construction as well?
Yeah. So I started on, get this right, the first week in April 2005, and the first I think dozer blade in the ground was the end of the beginning of March 2005. So literally still 210 acres of agricultural land, flat as a pancake. I remember doing the part of the interview tour with Gordon Moyle, and coastline was stunning, but I mean, the rest of it was just literally 210 acres of just flat with a bit of a slope towards the coast. And I'm thinking, this could be, I'm interested to see what this can yield, certainly. So, but it basically right from the very, very, very start, which was a fantastic opportunity.
Yeah. Well, there's a funny story that happened, and it was probably not long, well, the construction had done. I'm guessing the course was at the grow-in phase, but you would have been there then. But, I had a big van, like a 9-passenger van. There are 8 of us. I'm driving us back from, I don't know where we were that day, probably King's Barnes or Crail or Ely, one of those courses. We're coming back along the road there, and we see a construction site. And we knew that that was going to be the 7th course. So we pull in, and then we're turning our van around, and I'm in the grass, the newly planted grass. And someone, it could have been you or Gordon, comes running out like screaming obscenities, get the, you know.
I didn't have a beard. I didn't have a beard back then, and certainly less gray hair, so I'll apologize if that was me.
Well, I'll tell you what, that course, as you said, has stunning views back into the town of St. Andrews, the castle, the cathedral, and all that. And what they've done with that property, or what they did to that property, was amazing. And to be truthful, it's one of our favorite courses there. Our clients love it, other than the climb up the first hill. They absolutely love it. Personally, I love holes, well, a bunch of holes, but the ones that stick out are 9, 16, 17, and 18. That shared green on 9 and 18 is just fantastic. 17 is one of the best par threes in Scotland.
There's
So
an interesting story to 17. So just before I started, obviously David McLay Kidd was given the commission to design, and he walked the site. And at that point, the area that is now the 16th green and the 17th tees, the Links Trust, two small sections of land. The section that takes you from the 8th green to the 9th tees through that little path, and the section that is the 16th green and the 17th, they hadn't purchased those. So David asked if they could go back to the landowners to say, can you negotiate? Because he obviously saw the potential for 16 green and 17th tees, a little bit tight. He said ideally size-wise, but he says we can't not build that. So they went back, is my understanding, to the landowners that they purchased off to renegotiate to get, because that area, which is the 16th green, 17th green, if you look up to your right-hand side, I'm not sure if there still is, there used to be an off-road driving area, but that off-road driving area was in where the 16th green, 17th tees were. So part of the agreement for buying that area was that the Links Trust would then build another 4x4 area to the right of that. So, and then again, that little parcel land from the 8th green to the 9th tees, which is crucial for those. 8's a fantastic little par three, but then you're stuck. So they bought that little parcel land from, I think it was, at least I bought it, I thought, from Scottish Water, which brings you to that stunning short drivable par four, which is number nine.
Well, there's still a water treatment plant in the middle of that, isn't there? Or in the middle.
Yes, they were interesting neighbors at times
I can
when it
imagine.
came to some of the, especially it was okay. Winter months, they would sometimes do some maintenance, which certainly got your attention.
I can imagine. I can imagine. Now, one thing that happened, and I played the course both before and after, but when it first opened, it didn't open to rave reviews. People felt that the greens and the green complexes were kind of harsh or unforgiving. And I know eventually, shortly after opening, they softened it, if that's the right word. Were you involved in that?
I mean, certainly the if you go back to the start of the construction, I remember David Kidd and his kind of lead associate at that time was Paul Kimber. That David's, you know, he says, we've got 210 acres of flat farmland. He says, constraint is not an option. Because there's too many places you try to build a links course on land that's definitely not, it's not links. So that they looked at the braes, as you call it, the cliffs that run from like the 16 right through to the 17th tees.
Yeah.
And what they did is they just hauled, it's interesting to look at it next to, they hauled the landforms. So they looked at where the landforms were on there and they hauled it up onto the golf course, built massive landforms and then built the holes in or within the landforms. So I think the key success to the whole golf course again was to shape everything in the Links Trust where it wasn't in the budget at the start, but to look to, you know, the big flat areas in between holes, that the undulations and the natural shapes, if you then become flat for 100 yards, it just doesn't work.
Right.
So they agreed to shape the whole place. And it was, again, the greens within the landforms, and it's difficult, you know, when we built them, we knew that there was shape to them and there's movement to them, but until actually people start to play it, Jeff, it's difficult to sort of understand what's going to happen. So we opened in 2008 and they had the little shapes within the fairways. We thought, look, it's going to be nice. It's going to be really, really wide. I mean, I think like the left is six to the right is six. Yeah. It's something like 90 yards. So it's very, very wide. So I thought we need to put some shapes within the fairways to make this look like it's like a natural site. Right. So it became quite, when opening that, maybe the balls were running off greens too easily. They were getting caught in these tussocks or tufts in the middle of the fairways. And obviously, we reviewed that at the end of our first season, which was 2008. And Gordon, myself and a few others, and I said, look, we need to maybe look at adding some shelves. So we started that pretty much in year one, just building little shelves. Because the USG specification as a tier or a layered construction method is people say, well, just take the top off, but you go, well, you've got a set depth of 325 of sand.
Yeah.
That's critical for performance, for it to work above the gravel layer. So we finished up just adding bits to, like, so the right of the second green where it used to run off. We built that shelf.
Right.
Right of three. If you go through, I mean, most green sites have been touched or tweaked. Not the greens themselves, but certainly the surrounds have been lifted up and you've created shelves. And I think if my memory serves me right, in the first couple of years, between either completely removing or turning or twisting some of the tussocks, we did about, I'm going to say about 40. Just to make it more playable, make it more enjoyable.
I think there was a big misunderstanding. I think people felt that the greens were unfair, or at least that was the commentary at the time. But but you didn't touch the greens. You touched the surrounding areas that made the greens more playable. Really,
yeah. We had David was still involved, but it was Paul Kimber because Paul was based in Scotland, so he would come on to site. We would kind of feedback. We'd look at where the divots were going to gather, and maybe unfairly played ourselves, to be honest. And that kind of, you're thinking it's very difficult to hit green, like number phenomenal hole at number nine. But if you've got no shot to hit it, then it could be the best looking hole in the world. It needs to be enjoyable. Yeah. So what Paul said, well, we're not going to take away, not going to guarantee anybody a par, but what we should be doing is at least guarantee people, if they miss the green, that it should be a bogey.
Yeah.
Rather than double. So that was the kind of the concept of no bring them back on, but holding them. So if they ran off, they ran into a little collection area, then you can just put back up to the pin. Hopefully you're making no worse than a bogey.
Well, you know, I think the other thing that makes the Castle course stand out is that when you think about it, if you're playing the other six courses that are owned by the Lynx Trust or managed by the Lynx Trust, I guess is a better way of putting it, mm-hmm. You don't get a particularly, well, you get a much warmer welcome out at the Castle course, right? It's only a little bit more expensive, but they've got someone there to unload the clubs out of the car. It's more of an American style, right? They've got a practice facility. They've got a clubhouse with their own merchandise. It's dedicated to that course. Yeah. And you get a very warm welcome.
Yeah, a parking area where you can actually get a spot.
Right.
So someone said one of the locals had said, technically we've got our own private golf club as part of our membership.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And what I tell people when they ask me, hey, can we want to play these courses within the seven? And they've got some misnomers, like they think that, as an example, they've heard through online blogs and so forth that the new course is actually the best course there, right? And so when I've talked to locals, I'm not saying that it's unanimous this way, but what they've said, just as an example, is that the old course is the most historic, the castle's the most scenic, the Jubilee's the most difficult, and the new is their favorite. And I'm they don't generally talk about the Eden or the Strathtyrum or the Balgo, but that, and so you've got four wonderful choices there, right?
Yeah, you do.
It's phenomenal. So well, you then after that you moved to Turnberry, and that's been 9 years, but you spent 10 years with St. Andrews, the Lynx Trust.
I did. I mean, phenomenal organization, phenomenal place. Really, just all about the golf and the kind of experience that they try to kind of produce or promote or give to everybody. Great place, fantastic investment, great people. No, really, really love. Really, really did enjoy my time there.
Well, you, as we talked, you moved to Trump Turnberry at a very hectic time. Lots going on. Tell me about your role through that, because not, I mean, when I think about the golf course, there were major renovations done to the Ailsa course, but then in addition to that, Robert the Bruce course was completely renovated as well, correct?
I mean, full site renovation. When I came across in early part of 2015, at that point, the pitch and putt was under construction. That was the first thing we did in a couple of months here. We toughed that at the early part of 15, and then they rolled straight into, don't know if you remember, the Golf Academy used to have the little short range covered bay area in the short range. Yeah, so the short range that was removed, and then we built a, it's probably as good a short range facility that you're going to have. It's a hectare in size. It's got five greens, bunkers, chipping areas. It's a fantastic facility. So we did that at the early part of 15. I think keenness for the owners at that point to move quicker than that, but obviously we had contracted for the Ladies British Open in the Ricoh at the last couple of days of in July, early first 2 days in August of 15. So we had that on the agenda, and at the same time, we were obviously planning for a full resort shutdown because when the Ailsa closed on the 28th of September of 15, so did the hotel for a full refit. When I arrived here, obviously, in so it must have been back at, I'm going to say September, October of 14, they closed the clubhouse for a full renovation as well to get that ready for the Ladies British Open. So that, and then rolled into the full renovation of the Ailsa, opened that in the first of June 2016. And then because the contractor's here in the early part of 16, we rolled straight into the renovation of some of the holes in the Kintyre, which obviously became King Robert the Bruce. And then we did some work on the Arden, so and then the spa was done. So basically, full resort. I mean, the place from 2014 with the new owners, the place is unrecognizable, and the standards are as good as you'll get anywhere. They're fantastic.
Well, I've been to I'm not I haven't been to any of the Trump resorts in the States, but I've been to all of them in Scotland and Ireland. And what's amazing to me is, regardless of an American's political stance on Donald Trump, what I would tell anyone that when he gets involved in a golf course, particularly the four that I've been to overseas, they're spectacular. What he did to Dunebag He made it a much better golf course. And I to be truthful, I haven't been back to Turnberry since the changes that you've just described. But everyone I know who's been there, professional and otherwise, say it's just spectacular. He made it better, right?
You're definitely, if next time you definitely need to get down next time you're over.
Well, I'm going to be there in October. I'm staying there and playing there. I'll be
Ah, brilliant.
there for a Golf Connect Scotland event that'll be there in late October.
I'd love to hear what your thoughts are.
Well, you'll have to buy me a pint, or I'm not opening my mouth.
If it, I'll give you I'll, we can do three, we'll get 3 pints.
3 pints and a whiskey, and then
And
I'll tell you everything.
a nip.
No, but I think truly, the can you talk about the changes to both courses? And why don't we start with the King Robert the Bruce? Because that course, I remember it had some very memorable holes, right? There was one, I don't remember the number, that kind of went down towards the sea and the green was sighted down near almost in a cliff. That was a
That was the
spectacular
old.
golf hole.
That was the old eighth into that cove. The diff it was a beautiful hole, but it crossed number nine, and then nine crossed number eight, and then so they kind of they compromised each other, and then didn't make the sort of the full use of the view. So the routings changed. So you basically used to play anti-clockwise. You now play clockwise. So basically, you come up the hill from number seven. So the first 7 holes are basically the same, apart from a couple of tweaks here and there. And then you basically the eighth is down what was the old 10th, and then so where the 10th tees is where the so that the your the views are arguably probably the best views in the whole property of when you're on the new eighth green, because you've got you feel like you're on top of a hill, or top of a you're just on this peninsula, because you've got Ailsa Craig in the background, you've got Lighthouse in the background, you can see the War Memorial, you can see straight across to Arran, and then nine plays to is over the cove. So where the eighth green used to be, that you play over that op that cove is now a big open sand area. You play to the ninth green that used to be where the new ninth green is where the ninth tees used to be. So that's stunning difference to that top section. So and then the rest of it, we just did a bunker renovation, and we're still looking at doing some bits and bobs going forward. We'll maybe look at doing some work on some of the tees. So made some significant changes. And again, it's one of these. It's it, not a shame, but the reality, I suppose, that having a golf course next to one of the world's best is that it overshadows. But I always say, if the King Robert was the golf course that you pegged up every weekend as a member, you would certainly be more than happy.
Well, I feel the same way, and I think if you think about it, have you ever played Ballybunion?
I have, yep.
Did you play the other course, the Cashin?
I tried.
It was too difficult for you?
I was so windy. And
Well,
those small greens, whoa,
I'll tell you what my what
what
I
a
thought.
sight.
I played it on a calm day, and I remember when we finished, we were looking at each other like, "Can you believe how good that is?" Right? And while the greens are small, we played it on a calm day and loved it. And there are a number of courses like that, whether it's the newer the Jubilee next to the old, or King Robert the Bruce next to the Ailsa course. It reminds me of if I said, "Have you seen the Mona Lisa in the Louvre?" And you say, "Yeah." I go, "Well, name the masterpiece that's right next to it." And you can't name it because everyone's attention is on the primary, the reason that everyone's there. And there's no reason to miss it, King Robert the Bruce. That course is exceptional from what I understand now.
No, it's a great addition, that's for sure. We did a little bit of work on even the 9-hole Arran course. We've did a little bit of naturalization, a little bit different. We've got naturalized bunkers throughout, so very kind of counted down on a mini scale. But a great, five par threes and four par fours, and the second of the irons like 90 yards long. It's takes about an hour and a half to get round. It's a fantastic little addition.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So, talk about the major changes that you undertook with the Ailsa course.
They also, we finished up rebuilding all 19 green sites that existed, and we put back a new putting green. Some went back in existing areas, but the main changes, I suppose, we pushed the first green. So the first is basically 50 yards longer than it used to be. So it used to be like a short iron, a long iron and a flick. It's about 50, 60 yards further back now. The fourth green is pushed back a little bit. The par three, it's lowered. Fifth green went back a little bit. Six, par three, top of the hill, shortened to allow 18. If you remember, the championship tees at 18 used to be that 90-degree dog leg. The tees are now up on the dune that used to be back left of what was the existing... so basically, the old six used to play are now up on top of the hill. But the main change, as opposed to going through everything, would be that obviously the ninth became the part, the famous, you know, well photographed par three next to the lighthouse now.
Right.
Tenth it became is now a par five. The tenth green is where the 11th tees used to be, so infinity green. 11 is a brand new par three that goes back and back left, which I think they looked at that, you know, being George Brown, the legendary superintendent here, he looked at that back in the sort of 90s, but, you know, I think that to have an owner with a vision and the I suppose willingness to invest in what needed to what was needed to be invested to get it to where it is now, the previous owners weren't, you know, committed to or prepared to do that. So 11 becomes a par three, long and left where the old hole used to be. 14 is now a par five because the ninth went to a par three. The 14th green is now up on what was the old ninth fairway. So you get another look. When you come up to the 14th green, you're just looking right back down at the lighthouse.
Yeah.
And the coastal holes again. And then 15, 16, 17 is the main change. It was it reduced from a par 5 to a par 4 to allow 18 to be played as a straight hole.
Got it. Got it.
And then bunkers were all naturalised on the fairways. And we've went with that kind of... I suppose that northern look, Dornoch, Skibo area where we burn the faces off.
Yeah.
And actually of the greenside bunkers, which I really like that contrast with the dark versus the green of the turf. So, but no, taking probably the holes on the hill so that I'm sure people over the decades looked at like a nine would have been a phenomenal part. You know that you play a golf, oh, that'd be a great hole in there or phenomenal addition there. We all do that as golfers and architects, but I think with the, you know, to have an owner with a vision and a commitment to say, look, let's just do it. Well, finished up what we've got now.
I think for those of us that have played it, and even before these changes, it was a wonderful golf course, and it had such great history. And, yep. And you know, for people who are maybe new to the game, 1977 there, they had what's called the Duel in the Sun, and it was a, really, it came down to Jack Nicklaus and Tom Watson, and just an amazing finish for both golfers, really. Jack Nicklaus out of the rough and Tom Watson hitting a beautiful approach. It was a wonderful show of sportsmanship at the end where they walked off the green arm in arm. And so that's great history. And then in 2009, of course, Watson was involved again and hit what he felt was a perfect 8-iron into 18. It hit on the downside of a hump over the green, and he couldn't get up and down and ended up losing in a playoff to Stewart Cink. But and I don't know if you've heard of the Lynx Diary, but it's a Scottish magazine, golf magazine. It's not a typical golf magazine that there's no instruction. It's all about how beautiful the game is. They got wonderful photography and articles, and they just wrote a piece on Tom Watson, and they focused on those two tournaments at Turnberry. It was really well done. But
yeah, some great champ. I remember watching that one 2009. It was you feel really sad for Stewart Cink, but I mean I was. When Watson hit the 18th fairway and he hit his second shot, I'm up off my chair thinking, you know, he's loving that. And I'm thinking, we're watching a bit of history here. And then, it was, yeah. So the boy said that worked here. He says, once, it's a shame. He says, after the playoff, it felt like a wake.
Yeah. Yeah. That was, I mean, at 59, he would have been the oldest major champion, and clearly, obviously, the oldest Open champion as well. But
Yeah.
it was a wonderful, wonderful spectacle. And I was like you, I was on the edge of my seat thinking, I can't believe this is about to happen.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Spectacular. You know, the other thing for people that are watching that haven't been there, behind me, what you're seeing is the lighthouse, which is out around the ninth hole, as Alan described it. But beyond that is a large island or rock called the Ailsa Craig, which is obviously where you get the name, the Ailsa course. But that's also the rock where all the curling stones in the world come from. Isn't that correct?
That is, I believe that. Yeah, that is in all the, I think, the Olympics and some of the world bigger championships. I think it's the stones are all sourced and they're all still to this day come from the Ailsa Craig.
Yeah. Interesting tidbit of information. So right now it's obviously a slow season for you. It's been rainy, it's winter there. What types of projects are you working on over this winter?
Mainly, we just kind of work on our the greenside bunkers, like our revetted greenside bunkers. Depending, obviously, how much traffic and how much play they get, we'll get an average maybe 2, 3, maybe 4 years on some of them. But we usually try and get through about 30
Yeah.
per year. So not quite as many done this year because it's been a little bit on the wetter side. But working on that and just turf and grassland management, aerification, and it's still quite a busy course, Brett, because I think the the days of not seeing enough a lot of winter traffic, members still want to play, and we're still busy, so we're obviously still prepping for golf,
Yeah.
and obviously fairly a little bit mild, some milder winters you're doing a little bit of still a little bit of mowing. So, but now I'll be busy on the construction front, and we do some obviously projects in our gardens and grounds as well, and some landscaping. So, different kind of busy, as I say, in the winter.
Yeah. Well, I've got another question for you, and that has to do with the type of welcome people would get, or what can they expect when they come to play the two courses that you have there at Turnberry?
From a certainly from a welcome perspective, we're kind of hopefully legendary for our kind of authentic Scottish welcome. So, customers will get that from that obviously 5-star authentic is kind of key for us. Welcome when they arrive here, and obviously from a golf perspective, obviously hopefully we're ticking everybody's boxes when it comes to conditioning and what we give them. And you've got a phenomenal, couple of golf courses, whether it's the Ailsa or the King Robert or the Arran, or it depends on your golfing ability. We've got, if you're a here's a resident as well and you're not a golfer, we've got our obviously Arran course. We've got the little pitch and putt, which is popular. So, yeah, great, great destination for pretty much cater for every kind of caliber or standard of golf.
Yeah. Well, you're in a beautiful part of Scotland, but it's also somewhat remote. What would you recommend to visitors that they do when they're not playing golf?
I mean, from a you've obviously at the resort, if you're not playing golf, we've got our obviously our own on-site resort spa, and we've got shooting, we've got our fishing, horse riding, and stuff. Lots and lots to do on property for the non-golfer. But locally, you've obviously got Killeen Castle. You can go to Arran. Certain times, I think you can still get a boat trip to go round Ailsa Craig, or you used to.
Yeah.
From a sightseeing perspective, so a fantastic part of the world, loads to do, loads to visit, and Galloway Forest if you're into a bit of outdoor activities. The Galloway Forest isn't far away, and it's another beautiful part of the world as well.
Excellent. Now, when we're over in that part of the world, there are some amazing golf courses nearby as well. What other courses would you recommend? That are nearby that perhaps North Americans wouldn't have heard of.
Yeah, I suppose for us, most of our customers would probably look to tie in probably Royal Troon and obviously Prestwick and that open, the links of Ayrshire, the Open Championships. But you've got Dundonald, we've got Glasgow Gaels, you've got Western Gaels, Brassey, some really, really good golf courses, just to name but a few largs. So there's some really nice ones up in this neck of the woods for if you want to sort of tie a full weekend. Certainly wouldn't be hard to, you know, from some great golf courses in this area.
Yeah. Well, I think you could stay at the Trump Resort for a week and never play the same course twice, right? There's plenty of golf in that
Well,
area.
yep.
Right.
Certainly is. Certainly is.
So I'm gonna ask you a load of
Western Gales. I forgot Western Gales as well. Let's not forget Western's a great track. I don't know if I mentioned Western Gales.
Yeah, you did. That is a wonderful track. So I've got a loaded question for you. So other than Trump Turnberry, what's your favorite course in Scotland?
Oh, I'll leave out both Trump properties, and I'll go neutral. It's difficult because you've got such a variation of, from your, like, say, your Dunaverty's, which is your £30, no bunkers or minimal bunkers, stuff like that. But if you ask me to put them on the spot, I think probably need to be the old. I think the old just got that little bit of,
yeah.
I love quirky, I love old style, I love my golf history, and there's always that.
Yeah.
You know, you'll see it yourself, Jeff. There's just something, the aura and the just, you can feel the history when you even stand on that first tee. That, you know, I've taken guests on that they can barely peg it up. The hands are shaking that much.
Yeah.
And it's just a wonderful place. And I think the atmosphere of the town, so I'd probably go with, just that bit of different. There's some other fantastic tracks that we've played, but I think if you'd nail me down to one, I would probably say the Old Course.
Yeah, I've I know you've played it quite a bit having lived there, and I've played it about a dozen times. I told someone this morning that if I had a tee time and I was with someone who hadn't played, I'd gladly give it up to let them have that experience, because I've had it more than my share for someone that lives in North America. But that's a great choice. And it's St. Andrews, it's not just the course, it's the whole town, it's the history of the course and the property and Old Tom and all the great things that have happened there. It's just remarkable.
I mean, you watch the professionals, and to them it looks, I always found it difficult to score on.
Yeah.
It's so hard to get it close.
Yeah.
It's so hard to trust it, because you stand there and you look at it, it's telling you you've got 129 to the pin, and you go, it can't be.
Yeah.
Can you be? So you hit the club that's going to basically keep you short, or hit you way, way short, just to prove a point to yourself. I don't know why we do that. And then you always inevitably finish like 40 yards from the flag.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, like the fifth hole at the old is, you don't want to be short there.
Yeah.
Right. If if anything, you want to be left so that you're more on the 13th side of the green than the fifth, but, yeah,
I remember.
The more you play there, the more you get the subtlety of it. The breaks of the green, the green, like number two, the green complex is just unbelievable.
Oh, yeah. If you get on the wrong side of some of these, I do remember I was lucky enough to be there for like two, when there was two Opens being hosted in 2005 and 10. I remember, I think it was the pin on the Sunday in 2010. Still laugh to this day. The fifth was 86 yards on.
Wow. That's crazy, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, 86 yards. Phenomenal.
Yeah, we had I was playing, this is probably 15 years ago. We had a group of friends over. We were playing the old. We were on number two. And one of my playing companions sunk a 93-foot putt. Right now, there are very few courses in the U.S. where you could even – they're not 30-yard wide greens, right?
Yeah.
It was one of the, like, best things I've ever seen live on a links course, to see him make that putt.
Yeah. It's just so strange or unique to watch the ball run on the surface for that long and then disappear.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I know you'll recall this, but I think it was 2 years ago at – the Masters 18, where Rory, I think he went first on 18. He was in the sand.
Yep.
And he holed it. And I counted with a timer how long it took from the time he struck the ball to the time it went in the hole. 13 seconds. Right. I mean, because it landed softly and then just slowly, and then it just kind of crept in the hole. And then was it then right after that, was it Colin Morikawa who
Gonna
holed
say, I
out?
think it's Colin Morikawa. I think it was.
Yeah.
Don't think we'll see that again.
Yeah, 13 seconds, right? It
Phenomenal.
was unbelievable. So next question would be, what course anywhere in the world that you haven't played would you most like to play?
I think it's probably the one that, and again, I'm sure most people say that. I think it would be. I'd love to play Pine Valley, probably.
Yeah.
There's probably two or three. There's probably Cyprus. There's probably Royal Melbourne. Some of the classics. And
Yeah.
there's probably a few that that we probably don't get the luxury of seeing that we're probably they're tucked away, but. I'd probably say just to have a shot at Pine Valley. So one day, maybe one day.
Yeah, that's I think that's probably a close second to Augusta National. So
I was lucky enough to have a wee hit around there in 2006.
I knew you had played there because you didn't
Mr.
mention
Moore.
it.
Mr. Moyer had organized that for us, so that was one of them. If you ask for it as a golfing experience, that would be that just because of what it is. It's like playing. I think it's between the feeling of playing Augusta or being there is very similar to the feeling of probably playing the Old Course.
Yeah. I think it's a great experience for any greenkeeper, whether they play it or attend the Masters Golf Tournament, to see the condition that that's in. I mean, because I think it's changing, but 25 years ago, 30 years ago, when I started going over there, a lot of Americans didn't like how unkempt links courses were. They were expecting golf courses maintained like Augusta National. Even though most of us don't belong to clubs like that, the courses that we have are meticulously maintained, not as natural. And so, what was your experience like as a greenkeeper playing that course and seeing the level of attention to detail on every turn?
It was interesting because if you look at likes of the if like the old or likes of some of the Open Championship venues here, you go to them and you go to them in like a normal season. When you look at it from an Open Championship perspective, then the guys just do a little bit more, but it looks very, very similar. I don't think that because of the expectation on the properties anyway or the courses that I don't think the rise from daily play up to maybe Open Championship play is that. Is that big a jump? We're lucky enough to play Augusta in the February, and but when you watch the tournament, I mean, it is the unbelievable the difference. It was great when we were there, but it was just a run-of-the-mill setup for the day, and the tournament itself was like, I mean, what a work of art, nothing out of place. So to go from already high to, I mean, almost unachievable for anybody else. Now, I know they've got the resources and I know they've got the manpower and they've got the technology, but that to deliver that year in, year out, that just because you've got the everything at your fingertips doesn't guarantee success, but just phenomenal, phenomenal. Round of applause for those guys, that's for sure.
I don't know if you know this, but under the flower beds, particularly on the back nine, like the holes 12, 13, 14, they've got heating and cooling units so that they can raise or lower the temperature so that on Sunday, Master Sunday, the colors of those azaleas and magnolias are at their perfect bursting color.
I mean,
I mean,
what those guys deliver every year is phenomenal. For the consistency year in, year out
yeah.
is amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Now I've heard what you said about the high condition of a course like Turnberry or the Old Course or Troon or Carnoustie or any of the championship venues, open venues in the U other parts of the UK. But I when I think about that, I've heard it say that on the old course that if they could hold a championship any day of the week, that it's literally in, that it doesn't get upgraded for the Open Championship.
No, not, I mean, for things like the guys will maintain the likes of, for the likes of Dunhill, the guys will just continue the maintenance that they do for likes of the Autumn Medals. And then because of the kind of the sustainability of the turf and how that links tight turf, you know, from an inputs perspective, is hard wear and without a lot of nutritional inputs, it just, all the guys will probably do is increase, you know, timely top dressing, look at when the tournament is and figure out last applications. And then basically it's just increasing frequency of cut, attention to detail, right, or the detail side of it. And not, so to lift it from an op, from a daily play to an Open Championship is, yeah, it's a lift, but it's just more kind of doing more of the same as much as anything.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. I've got one last question for you, and that is, you know, a lot of the guests that we have that come over are visiting Scotland for the first time. They're playing Lynx golf for the first time. You've been playing golf for a very long time, starting with a 35-pound set of clubs. What advice do you have for North Americans coming over to play Lynx golf in Scotland for the first time?
I would probably say one would be maybe buy a 60-degree sand wedge. Would be a good starter for 10, working on trying to get out some of these links bunkers. I think as well, sometimes the I think there's always the perception that we're always going to be brown.
Right.
Because of obviously maybe watching the Open Championship and in the middle of summertime, but obviously people, we get, you know, and a lot of people come across and go, I've been playing golf in links courses in Scotland and they're a little bit greener, but obviously if it's raining quite a bit, obviously, the brown is dictated to by, you know, weather conditions of, if it's warm, it's sunny, it's dry. The obviously, the nature of turf that goes dormant, right, it goes dormant, starts to brown off. But that it might not always be as brown. But I think, you know, links golf, you played it a lot yourself, Jeff. It's like take the rough with the smooth. You're going, right, to get some good breaks. You're going to get some bad ones. Work on maybe that. Keep the ball on the ground, and if you can, as you mentioned, St Andrews, if there's an opportunity to get, I've always, if there's any opportunity to get the putter on the ball, get the putter on the ball.
Yeah.
Whether you're sort of, and then get used to that. You know, you're going to get a couple of days where you could be, you could hit your six iron 230 yards, or you could hit your six iron 90 yards. So that's something that maybe the US customers or golfers will maybe know used to that sort of the effects of the wind. And I think probably finish, I'd probably, the green speeds of, you know, we're not, because of the windiness of the sites, that, I mean, our summer is about 9.5, and that's kind of our grass species and our sustainability of our grass species, yeah, to give us 12 months of golf is, you know, just working on not taking them too low, but obviously, yeah, factoring the fact that you may be putting down 40 mile an hour wind. So probably that. So that's probably the...
So your point right now is that Turnberry's in perfectly green because of all the rain.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, we'll begin. So the Lynx golf courses, they only go, they'll go brown to basically protect themselves or sustain themselves through dry spells. But pretty much like if you look at the courses that have just been playing in Phoenix, where there's the Bermuda goes brown because it goes dormant.
Right.
Fescue and your finer Lynx grasses do exactly the same. So if they've no enough water because of, you know, lack of rainfall, then they will start to go brown. And that's just basically the switch off. They go dormant. And then that sustains them till it rains, and when it starts to rain, they'll green up and come back again. So yeah, so some summers were maybe brown, but some summers we could be green, because as if it's raining, we'll be green, and if it's not, we'll be brown.
Yeah, yeah, excellent. Well, that was the last question, Alan. Thank you so much for investing your time with us today. I can't wait to share this with all of our, all of our fans, if you will, that follow us on social media and follow us on YouTube. So it was a great pleasure to have you. We learned a lot about Turnberry and your career. Thanks so much for, again, investing your time with us.
Jeff, thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, again, for tuning in today. And thank you, Alan Patterson. If you like this video, please share it. like and subscribe so you know when the next video comes out. Thank you so much.